And in terms of your ability to access electricity, internet, phone lines, and communication to the outside world, what's it been like?
So we have intermittent internet at times. Electricity also is on and off. Electricity has been even worse over the last, I would say, 4 or 5 days, just because the fuel for the hospital is running out and they're trying to conserve it. So they've been cutting off electricity to some of the wards and trying to preserve it for like the operating room and the ICUs in order to make it last as long as it can go. There is, again, I have almost no cellular service. The wireless does get, internet in some locations, and it's like random. So like, I was having a little trouble before getting on this show, so I was a little frantic trying to find a good spot and finally got it. So I'm glad I'm here.
Well, we really appreciate you making that contact with us. If you can describe the situation with the Israeli military moving into Rafah, cutting off the border crossing, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who are displaced from all over Gaza now heading back north, and what's happening in the hospital you're in Khan Yunis, and particularly the children that you're treating?
So most of my patients are children. My average patient's about 12 or 13 years old. They range from the youngest one I've taken care of is about 4, and the age goes up to like mid-60s or 70s. The people, since the invasion of Rafah, we've had a lot of the hospital personnel leave because they are trying to get their families out of Rafah. Many of them have either moved there from other parts of Gaza, or they have lived there and they're trying to flee. I just saw a nurse this morning. I met him the first week that I was here. He hasn't been around for 7 days, and I just saw him. It was like, he looked dehydrated. He looked completely exhausted. He basically broke down and cried, telling me what he went through. He basically went to take his family out of their home and take them basically all along, out into like a clear area that was a designated safe zone. He took his wife. He has 2 daughters, one that's 2 years old, another that's 3 months old. They went to a place that had absolutely no shelter. He basically said it's like the desert there. He said that they had no tents. They had no water. They had no food. The other day, he had to stand in line from dawn to about sunset just to get a jug of water for the family. He says that he has like absolutely no electricity, has no water. And he basically broke down and cried because he says, like, I feel like an animal. I don't know what to do. When we go to the bathroom, I dig a hole in the ground and we go there. His family, a week before, his extended family, his uncle and his cousins, were hit by a strike, an airstrike during the night, which killed most of them except one of his nieces and another cousin. So he said that they all passed away and died, were killed while they were sleeping. He said, I wish that would have happened to us, because at least we wouldn't have to go through what we're going through.
And Dr. Hamawi, 20 years ago, you provided life-saving care to now Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois when she was wounded in Iraq. Have you had conversations with her office about the situation there?
Yes, her office has been in contact with me, and I know she's doing everything she can to try to help us not only leave, but to provide that humanitarian aid into Gaza as well. I really appreciate everything she's doing.
Can you talk about the United States, where you come from? On the one hand, you have President Biden announcing he's halting a shipment of 2,000-pound bombs because he doesn't want them used in Gaza. He also said he wants Israel out of Gaza. At the same time, on the eve of today, he announced $1 billion of weapons to Israel. If you could speak with President Biden today, what would you tell him, Dr. Hamawi?
I would tell him, like, what difference from a 2,000, pound bomb from a 500-pound bomb? They're both going to kill civilians. He could stop this war right now. All he has to do is say, we are not going to give anything, and you need to stop. I don't care if you are our friend. If my best friend is a serial killer, I'm going to stop being his friend, and I'm going to tell him to do something. This isn't who we are. This isn't our country. This is not how I was raised. Not any of us, you know, what we were taught, what our nation is supposed to be. We're supposed to stand for freedom. We talk about that all the time. We claim to be the banner carriers for freedom across the world. And yet we have this this foreign policy that is so hypocritical in terms of providing a little bit of aid and a lot of bombs, and we're supposed to be, we're supposed to be like the United States of America. I mean, really, it's disheartening. It's going to haunt all of us when the truth, you know, I'm here, I see it with my own eyes. At some point in time, everyone's going to see it. I went out into Khan Yunis, and it is flattened. It looks like a nuclear bomb hit the center of town. There's not one building standing, and every building was entered in after it was bombed and completely vandalized. There's gunshots. There's graffiti everywhere that was placed after it was destroyed, making it completely uninhabitable.
Making it vandalized by who, Dr. Hamawi?
Well, the words on there are in Hebrew.
We only have seconds. Why did you go to Gaza? You are risking your life.
I am a surgeon. I have skills. I have been in war, and I've been on humanitarian missions in the past. I feel that I could make a difference. I've been trying to come here actually since December. I've reached out to many medical organizations, seeing who is coming and who has a slot, and I was offered one, and I came as soon as that opportunity was offered. This is who we are. You know, we try to help people. This is what I do. I did this, you know, when I was in Iraq. I was proud to be with a team of U.S. Army doctors that took care of everyone that came into our combat support hospital. We took care of U.S. military. We took care of contractors. We took care of Iraqis, and we took care of other nationals. It didn't matter who they were, because we treat human beings. I had the best job in the country there, and this is what I continue to do. I treat people as humans. And the way I am seeing this war conducted is not how we conduct wars, and this is not how we are taught in the United States, and this is not who we should be supporting.
Dr. Adam Hamawi, plastic surgeon, Army veteran, now trapped at the European hospital in Khan Yunis in Gaza, where he's volunteering with the Palestinian American Medical Association. Again, 20 years ago in 2004, he saved the life of now Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth, whose legs were blown off when she was serving in Iraq. Next up, Palestinians across the globe are marking the 76th anniversary of the Nakba. In English, it's catastrophe, when 700,000 Palestinians fled or were forced from their homes upon Israel's founding. We'll speak with a Palestinian historian in Amman. Stay with us. Somalia, México, República Dominica, Tanzania, fuera Yankee de América Latina, franceses, ingleses y holandeses, yo te quiero libre. الوضع بده الرضع صار الوضع بده الردع لكل السيد تحرر مستوطن اقتل مدلة المصاب حكيت ألسان أنا شرحت الهدار الإعلام سلاحهم طيب فبركون أما لما ألمي يدي برجع الواقع كما So Masood, we are south by Anna Tijoux and Shadia Mansour. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A far-right march to Gaza was part of the events this week marking Israel's Independence Day and the 76th anniversary of its founding. On Tuesday, a group of far-right Israelis, including a number of government ministers, marched in Sderot in southern Israel, calling for the resettlement of Gaza and expulsion of Palestinians living there. Israel's national security minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, said, quote, "First, we must return to Gaza now. We're coming home to the Holy Land. And second, we must encourage migration, encourage the voluntary migration of the residents of Gaza," unquote. This comes as Palestinians across the globe are marking the 76th anniversary of the Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic, when some 700,000 Palestinians fled from or were violently expelled from their homes, as Israel also carried out massacres upon its founding. Many Palestinians say they're facing a second Nakba today in both Gaza and the occupied West Bank. For more, we go to Amman, Jordan, where we're joined by Professor Abdel Razak Takhriti, a Palestinian historian, endowed chair in Arab Studies at Rice University in Houston, Texas. He's published widely on the history of colonialism and anti-colonialism in Palestine and the broader Middle East. Most recently, he co-created Thora, a political education project on Arab and Palestinian history on the Dig podcast. He's also active with Scholars Against the War on Palestine. Professor, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. If you can talk about the significance of this day.
Thank you, Amy. Well, first of all, I want to note that the numbers that are used by Palestinian historians now about the numbers of Palestinians that were expelled are at least 900,000. The Nakba witnessed the destruction of Palestinian society, the destruction of Palestinian urban life. The two most important cities, the cultural and economic capitals of Palestine, Haifa and Jaffa, were lost during the Nakba. A host of other cities were lost during the Nakba. 530 villages were completely depopulated during the Nakba. And out of a population of 1.4 million, you had the vast majority being displaced. So this is a very significant event in Palestinian history. It's a horrific event. And what's very shocking about it is that it was an internationally sanctioned event in many ways. It was the byproduct of a policy that was created by the so-called international community during the mandate period, when they instituted the mandate system under the League of Nations. And they did something very unique in world history, which is to sanction the establishment of a settler colonial presence in Palestine. So it's a very late settler colonialism, but it was a settler colonialism that led to the expulsion of the native population 30 years after the Balfour Declaration that instituted the settler colonial program in 1917.
And Professor Takhriti, the basis for the Nakba was laid by the British who held that mandate. Could you talk about their role in the repression of the Palestinians, especially in the 1930s?
Yes. So the British had actually been repressing the Palestinians from the very beginning. The main rule that was applied in Palestine was to arm the settler and disarm the native, and to punish the native for developing any ability to conduct self-defense. So you had a very aggressive settler colonial movement develop in Palestine under British rule, and it was armed under British rule. It was trained under British rule. The British, like Biden today, were claiming that they were even-handed. They were claiming that they took the interests of both sides. They were talking in these both-sided terms. But in reality, they were determined to establish a settler colonial project in Palestine. And they did succeed in horrific ways, actually. So, yes, Britain self-projects as an empire that was trying to do the right thing, in the same way that Joe Biden today tries to project this U.S. role as being fair and even-handed. But in reality, of course, they were pursuing this objective, which structurally led to the destruction of our people. Luckily, however, we have survived, despite the fact that they repressed us in during the 1936 revolt, which you were referring to. Although they destroyed the Palestinian countryside during that period, and they incurred heavy losses on us, that did not mean that our people did not continue. And even later on, when the settler colonist forces that were to establish the State of Israel expelled our population, our people continued to insist that they shall live. And today, we're witnessing the same level of resilience and insistence on resisting the reality of the Nakba, even today when we're facing the second Nakba unfolding in Gaza.
And also, could you talk about the efforts of the Israeli government to even prevent Palestinians from mourning what occurred in 1948, the Nakba law that is in effect?
Yeah, so this is a criminal trying to hide their crime. They've committed the crime. By the way, the current Israeli government, they're the descendants of the people that created the Nakba. And I'm talking here individually. So Netanyahu's father was a member of the Irgun, Ben Zion Netanyahu. That was a terrorist organization that carried out the ethnic cleansing of Yaffa. It bombarded the city of Yaffa, besieged it, mercilessly put its inhabitants under ruthless danger. Somebody like Yoav Gallant, who is currently engaging in major ethnic cleansing and genocide in Gaza, his father named them after Operation Yoav, which led to the depopulation and the expulsion of the majority of southern Palestine and its cornering into Gaza. So these people who were the children of those that committed this crime are trying to engage in Nakba denialism by banning the commemoration of the Nakba. They're trying to hide the crime so as to be able to continue committing similar crimes in the present. And this is a very important point. I've been engaged in Nakba education for a long time, and I always say we have to apply a four-principled rule to Nakba education. One, the Nakba happened. We must reject Nakba denialism in all its forms, including, by the way, the forms that are promoted by Israeli historians that are sometimes presented as reasonable on the Nakba. In this show, you've hosted people like Benny Morris before. Well, Benny Morris is a Nakba denialist, not because he disputes the idea that Palestinians were expelled from their villages, but because he denies that it was actually part of a plan. In the same way that now in Gaza, what we're witnessing is a plan unfolding. It's intentional. We must insist on intentionality. So the first point when we're dealing with Nakba education is to insist that the Nakba happened and to reject denialism in all its forms. Secondly, we need to insist on the fact that the Nakba is continuing. We have to understand that this is a colonial continuum. This is a structural process. It is not an event. And what we're seeing now in Gaza is very much connected to what happened in 1948. Thirdly, the Nakba must be stopped. So it's not enough to commemorate. It's not enough to talk about it. We have to stop it right now. And that means the first step to doing that is to stop the genocide in Gaza. And fourthly, it must be reversed. The Nakba must be reversed. And that means restoring Palestinian political and national rights, not only dealing with this as a humanitarian question. Despite the gravity of the humanitarian situation is a byproduct of the denial of the Palestinian political and national rights from the beginning of British colonialism to this very, very day.
Finally, Professor Abdel Razak Takriti, you have the Israeli Knesset member Ariel Kolner calling for a second Nakba, saying right now one goal Nakba, a Nakba that will overshadow the Nakba of 48. On the one hand, you have the you have Knesset members like these in Israel denying the original Nakba, but on the other hand, calling for a second Nakba. And in the United States, people like Congress member Tim Walberg suggesting Gaza should be bombed, quote, like Nagasaki and Hiroshima. While at the same time, these Republicans insist no genocide is underway. Your final comment in this last 60 seconds.
Well, this this is actually classic genocidal thinking. And it's also classic engagement with different audiences. On the internal audience front, the Israelis actually talk about genocidal plans openly, and they advocate them. And this has been happening for a long time. By the way, this is not just a byproduct of the Zionist right. It existed, and the Nakba was committed by the Zionist so-called left. It was the labor Zionism that committed the Nakba. They were presenting an image of self-defense to the external world, but they were actually engaging in very aggressive ethnic cleansing action and advocating it internally. The same is happening now. And we must understand that this is, again, an international process. The Israeli project is very much intertwined with American foreign policy towards the Palestinian people. They don't see us as human beings. They want to destroy us. But they know that they have to present it in self-defense terms so that it's palatable to the broader public. So in reality, however, this is just a racist criminal project that is leading and causing immense pain and suffering. As a descendant of Nakba survivors, it hurts me. It pains me to hear this discourse.
Professor Abdelrazak Takhriti, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian-American historian and chair in Arab Studies at Rice University in Houston, Texas, speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show here in New York, where last night students and workers at CUNY, the City University of New York, peacefully occupied the school's graduate center in solidarity with Palestine, renamed its library the Al-Aqsa University Library. Al-Aqsa was Gaza's oldest public university, destroyed by Israel's bombardment. The students ended their occupation after a few hours when they said they reached an agreement with the interim president at CUNY Grad Center to share their demands with upper administrators, including calls to divest from all financial ties to the Israeli military, remove New York police from campus, and drop all the charges against the protesters, including those arrested last month when NYPD violently raided a peaceful Gaza solidarity encampment on the City College campus in Harlem. Over 500 faculty and staff at CUNY have signed a letter to the chancellor, Felix Matos Rodriguez, demanding that the charges be dropped against at least 173 people who were detained at City College compared to 109 at Columbia. Quote, a predominantly white private institution, the letter says. For more, we're joined by a signatory to this letter. Alex Vitale is professor of sociology, coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at CUNY's Brooklyn College, author of The End of Policing. His piece for The Nation, Campus Police Are Among the Armed Heavies Cracking Down on Students. And we're joined by Musabika Nabiha, a CUNY alum and Palestine organizer, took part in the Gaza encampment at City College, where keeping her location private for security reasons. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's talk about the disparity in the treatment of the much more diverse CUNY University campus. Alex Vitale, you've looked at this.
Yes, I think on the one hand, you have very restrictive protest rules put in place by the CUNY administration, which just harbors a deep fear and kind of disregard of its own students, faculty, and staff. And then you have CUNY putting forward much more serious charges towards their students than the Columbia administration or the NYU administrations did towards their own students. And this really raises some questions about CUNY's views about their own students and their deep intolerance of student dissent on campus.
And I'd like to ask Musabika Navi how you took part in the Gaza encampment at CCNY, your thoughts on the administration's refusal to negotiate on divesting from companies complicit in the Israeli apartheid state?
Yes, the administration, both the CCNY administration and the CUNY administration, which includes Chancellor Matos, have refused to negotiate with us and instead chose to send in armed policemen to brutalize and violently arrest our protesters. And we know that the reason for this is that the demands that the students and workers are making are a threat to the university's profit motive. So the encampment put forward five demands. The first one was for CUNY to divest its $8.5 million from weapons and surveillance technology that perpetuates the colonization of Palestine. The second demand was for CUNY to institute an academic boycott of Israeli universities that are complicit in this genocide and in the broader colonization of Palestine. The third demand was for CUNY to express solidarity with the Palestinian resistance struggle. So this includes both uplifting and affirming the Palestinian people's moral and legal right to resist their colonization by any means necessary, as well as ending the repression of pro-Palestine CUNY students and workers. The fourth demand was for CUNY to demilitarize its campuses, so to get IOF members, cops, policemen, and the U.S. military off of our campuses. And finally, the fifth demand was for CUNY to return to being a fully funded, tuition-free people's CUNY that offers a fair contract to all of its workers. And we know that the violent repression that we saw, you know, was not because of the tents or the flags or the banners or just because of the political education, the free food that we had at our encampment. It wasn't because of that. It was because the encampment's demands themselves proved a threat to the constant accumulation of profit and profiting off of genocide that CUNY is engaged in.
And are the charges being dropped? Is there any discussion of the charges being dropped against those who were involved in the encampment, Musabika?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we know that some of the misdemeanors and summons have been dropped thus far by the DA. None of the felony charges have been dropped so far from the encampment itself. And we know that the DA cannot prosecute or would have a really hard time, you know, upholding these charges if CUNY administration refused to meaningfully participate in the prosecution. So we're calling on the administration to refuse to participate in the prosecution. And this is, again, why one of our demands is that CUNY stop retaliating and repressing its pro-Palestine students and workers. I mean, this is really the most egregious example we've seen of violent repression of pro-Palestinian organizing and views.
And Professor Vitale, we only have about 30 seconds, but could you talk about the Cops Off Campus Coalition and the significance, for instance, of Portland State students successfully getting a disarmament of their campus police?
CUNY is spending millions of dollars for a security apparatus that fails to address the real security needs of students and is really there in moments like this to be a tool, a kind of private army for the administration to suppress student dissent. Campuses should quit wasting educational dollars on producing their own police forces that just reproduce the same violence and the same kinds of overt control of protest activity that we see from the NYPD and other local police departments around the country. So this is part of a national movement of young people saying, we don't feel safe just because you put a bunch of armed police officers on our campus. We want real services that meet our real needs.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Alex Vitale, professor of sociology, coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at CUNY's Brooklyn College, author of The End of Policing, and Musabika Nabiha, a CUNY alum and Palestine organizer. We'll link to the 500-professor letter at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week, from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind.
The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.